I was more nervous with magic than I ever was with the psychological stuff.
Really? Because it was depending on... Yeah, you had to get it right.
Yeah, and so I was terrified
that
they'd see the secret. And that was what terrified me so much. So I'd feel physically sick at the point of going up to show someone a card trick. It terrified me. You would.
And that's terrible.
Can you imagine that as a magician? Yeah. Genuinely, like a working magician? Like, sort of bear with me. I'm going to just vomit all over your shoes. But let's do the magic trick now, okay?
Yeah. I'm ready. All right, people, welcome back to the Unconventionalist Podcast. I'm your host, Mark LaRousse, and this is the show about what it's really like to turn your message into a movement. And before I get into today's exciting and slightly scary guest, but for all the right reasons, I just want to let you know that we will be hosting a full-day boot camp on how to launch your own podcast on the 20th of September. So if you're keen of creating this same kind of show, but you want to speak to the people who inspire you and you want to broadcast those conversations, come along. You can get all the details on the website. It'll be below this video. Or if you listen to this on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcast, you can go and check out the show notes. So today's guest, I'm extremely excited. And I say a little bit afraid because I'm always afraid that something's going to happen. Next thing you know, I'm falling asleep on my microphone. And I'm, of course, talking about Aaron Calvert, who I saw, I believe, a couple of years ago in Edinburgh. We'll get into that in a second. But he is a professional hypnotist, although I'm sure there's different ways of describing what he does. And I can't wait to get into this conversation. So without further ado, Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Mark.
Yeah, it's really cool. How was the trip?
Oh, it was great. I was on a train from Preston down to London.
Yeah.
And it was full.
Yeah,
sweaty and late, so pretty much a standard trip, if I'm honest.
Sounds like exactly, because you're from Manchester, right?
Yeah, so I'm from Manchester originally. I live just outside of Manchester now.
Cool. Man, it's good to see you.
It's been since
I saw you, I'm trying to think, is it 2018? Last year?
Yeah, you saw me last year and dropped me a message. And we've been trying to arrange this for just shy of a year
now. And was it unclassified?
Declassified.
Close. Good. I'm dyslexic, so declassified. That was it. Yeah, and it was, mate. I loved it, and I'm really keen to get you on the show because there's much I want to unpack, especially when the title of the show is called Unconventionalist, and you've got quite an unconventional background, especially how you ended up doing what you're doing. But one of the first things I wanted to ask you, I guess, is: are people nervous when they meet you or when they know what you do?
Yeah, so you say, obviously, hypnotist. That's exactly how I describe myself. And when I say that, people obviously have these sort of expectations of making them cluck like chickens. And of course, that's because our expectations have been built by the TV shows and the comedy shows that we've seen in the past. And so when I say that, suddenly it's amazing because you watch them go back into the shell and go, oh my God, no, what are you going to do to me? And do you know what? I'm just saying hello. Like, that's about as far as the conversation's gone. But suddenly they don't trust you, which is great fun.
But there's one thing that I really enjoyed, because I did a bit of research, just heard a few of your kind of conversations and stuff online.
Sure.
One of the things which I never really thought about was that it's true that when you think about hypnotist or entertainment in that kind of way, it's often about, like, embarrassing people on stage. And I thought that was a really cool spin on it that you kind of brought the attention when you were sharing in different interviews, going, well, actually, what most people think is that it's a kind of a fun and most likely humiliating, like have an orgasm, you know, on stage.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know, dance with a mop and make out with it because you think it's Brad Pitt. That kind of comedy hypnosis, which is, you know, been vastly publicized. Yeah. And, you know, that's why people think it's going to be that when I say it.
Yeah.
But so when I saw a hypnotist on stage, I was about 15.
Yeah.
And it was exactly the show you described. And for me, it was funny, don't get me wrong, and there's definitely a market for it, and people love those types of show, but it just felt uneasy for me.
Mm.
You know, I don't want people leaving a show feeling either embarrassed or mortified by what they've done. You know, I've seen people strip on stage at these kinds of shows, and I'm going home going, how do you explain that to your parents who are also in the audience? Because, you know, it's a 23-year-old guy who's there with his mum and dad, and you know, I'm just like, there's got to be more to this than just using it for embarrassing people.
100%. But the way that it all started, it appears that you were around 8 years old and you saw a magician and you were like, that sounds pretty cool.
You've been doing your research well. I'm not sure who the mind reader is. You or me.
Yeah. And here's the version of the story that I wasn't sure, because I've heard two different versions. One of them was that you saw a magician at a popular kind of holiday resort.
Yeah.
And then that there was a shop in the back, like a castle.
Yes.
And another version I heard is that your gran bought you your first trick in Costco.
Yes. So you've
so clarify the story.
You've dug up my past. So the first magician I saw was at a Pontins holiday camp when I was 8 years old, and I was fascinated by it. I was watching someone perform miracles on stage, and there was gas in the audience. It was incredible.
Yeah.
And there was a shop at the back, and I bought one trick. I was allowed to buy one trick, it was a little red ball in a plastic case, and you put two strings through it, and then someone held it, and then you tied it around the hand, and you pulled the string through the hand.
Yeah.
Blew my mind. Absolutely blew my mind.
Do you remember what the trick was on stage that you saw the magician perform?
I think it was, so it was an illusion show. Okay. So there were, my dad got picked out of the audience, which was why I was immediately invested in it. And he put a box on his head and they put daggers or knives into this box. And then they opened it up and there was just knives there. His head had vanished. And, you know, it was amazing to see.
You didn't freak out?
No, it was great. I was
like, Dad!
I hoping he wouldn't come back. It's great, yeah. No, it was amazing to see that moment and have one of my family member involved, because it wasn't just the magicians on the stage.
Okay.
And so, you know, there's those big illusion shows which are incredible and they can do some amazing things.
Sure.
But for me, it is about that audience participation, because suddenly when you take it to that level, then it's less of a trick. It's more about you're living an experience through an audience member on stage.
Yeah, and I've been there. And I've been in your show and I was sitting in the audience and there's something I heard you say which was interesting. Someone, you know, one of the questions you must get all the time is, can everyone be hypnotized, right? Yeah. Is everyone likely to be hypnotized? And I thought you said something that was quite interesting. You said, like, actually some of the people who are, is it skeptical, word, or actually more likely to be hypnotized because they go in with an open mind as opposed to people who really want to get hypnotized. Like, you really want to go on.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you know, that is the question I get asked most. Can everyone be hypnotized? And the answer is yes. Yeah. Everyone can be. We all experience hypnosis. It's just a naturally occurring state. Okay. We have different names for it. Some people call it meditation. But it's that kind of state between the awake state and the sort of sleep dreaming state.
Okay.
And everyone can be hypnotized to different degrees of suggestibility. But when you're talking about sort of bringing people on stage to do these massive demonstrations, obviously you're looking for a very small number of people that can make that happen.
Yeah, because you don't want to bring people on stage and they're kind of resistant, doesn't work, and then next thing you know, you're spending half an hour trying to convince, you know, whatever it is. And
Absolutely. And I mean, there's lots of myth and there's lots of smoke and mirrors around hypnosis. And the truth of it is, it's just a state of concentration. If you focus on my words and you follow my instructions, it will absolutely work perfectly for you. So those skeptics who come in go, all right, might as well give it a go, see if there's any crack to this. They want to know. They want to find out whether they are able to be hypnotized or if they were right and they can't be. Yeah. And because of that, they follow the instructions, they go into it with an open mind. Yeah. Whereas the people who are like, go on, do it now, the whole way through, they're like, has it happened yet? Of course it's not, because they're not listening to me. They're so busy like peeking and opening their eyes and moving around and seeing if it's worked. And of course it's not worked, because you know, it's not a magical moment that happens. It's just a state of concentration.
Well, you have been called a modern day wizard by Telegraph.
Yes, that was a lovely quote, which will forever be on the poster, whatever show I'm doing.
And so you're 8 years old, you go through these kind of years of practicing you know, magic. And then around 12, 13, when you enter high school, something happens. You kind of fall out of love with magic, or you start realizing that your hands are too small for magic tricks.
I mean, well, a combination of all of the above, really. So as soon as I'd seen that magician and bought that first trick, it was very quickly Christmas after that, and that's when my gran bought me my first magic set.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. That's it. We got to
that's
the bottom
the full
of the story.
There we go. So I only dip into it.
Yeah,
different interviews.
100%.
So she bought me this first magic set, and that's where my love of magic began. And I remember the first trick that I kind of peeked behind the curtain on, because some of these were self-working. They were just kids' magic tricks. Okay. They did all the magic themselves. And I remember there was this plastic disc you put in a little pot, and you close the pot over and you put swords through it.
Okay.
And suddenly you can put swords through a solid object, and then you take the swords out, and the plastic coin is still where it was. And it's like, this is amazing. And I lifted up the little box and had a little peek inside while the coins, while the swords were in, and suddenly I was like, oh. Well, okay, that's not as amazing as I thought it was going to be. And so I went through this phase where it was great and I was buying all these tricks and I saw them online and they were amazing. I got to 12, 13 and I was in high school and sort of magic wasn't cool.
Yeah.
And then I started to be disappointed with that kind of secret not being as good as the reaction I'd had when I first saw it.
Got it.
And it took me a good few years to kind of mature and realize, actually, when you're buying a magic trick and you're learning it and you perform it for someone, you are delivering that experience that you first felt to them.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So that's the secret isn't necessarily what the trick is. The secret is how to make someone feel the way you did.
Got it. The excitement that you got receiving it wasn't necessarily replicated when you were giving it to someone else because you were like, oh, I know how it's done now.
Absolutely.
Oh, but actually, you're still amazed by it.
And that is the trouble with some magicians these days is that they're all in it for themselves.
Yeah.
So they, you know, the what separates the good and the bad magicians,
yeah.
the good magicians are in it for the audience. They want the audience to have the best experience they could possibly have. And that goes for sort of all levels of performers. So, you know, if you go and see a band, if they're creating music they want their audience to love and enjoy, that's great. If they're creating something that they think is just the best thing they could ever create, then...
And they don't care what people think about
it. Yeah, then that has its own place because it will find its own following. But it's the same for sort of magic in that sort of way.
So, quick time out. For people listening, including myself, what's the difference between a hypnotist, a mentalist, a magician, a fill in the blank? Like, if you had to school us in a really kind of bottom line version for people like me, who are just like, everything sounds confusing and everything sounds like, how would you kind of explain it?
Well, like you were saying, when I was about 15, I found hypnosis.
Yeah.
And that was where my sort of interest peaked again. And the reason was because suddenly it wasn't a trick on stage. You know, you go to a magic show and for the hour, 2 hours, however long it is, you suspend this belief. You suspend it and you go, okay, well, I know this isn't real. I know he's doing something with that card and it's going to move and he's going to put it in his hand and move it in some sort of way. Mm-hmm. It's not real, but the effect feels magical. But you suspend disbelief for for that short time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with hypnosis, when I saw it, there was a guy on stage with a microphone and he created miracles for both the people in their heads on stage and the audience watching.
Got it.
And I was like, that's fascinating.
Was that Darren Brown, the first time you saw on TV?
No,
or was that someone else on stage?
So that was someone else on stage. Okay. That was a comedy hypnotist.
Okay.
And then I very quickly found Darren Brown as well, who had that whole psychological twist. And suddenly we're into an area where the trick wasn't happening because of the sleight of hand. It was happening because of a psychological process on the person in front.
Got it. So it's not like a mechanical product in front of you, but rather the mind and how your the perception of what you're seeing and thinking and bending reality almost.
Absolutely, especially with hypnosis. And you can create a miracle. And so I have a co-writer and a director called Sam Fitton, who is a magician. That's his role. But he is a sort of broader performer than that as well. And I remember the first time he saw me perform hypnosis, he pretty much hung up his coat and sort of sat back and just went, what the hell?
Wow.
If I wanted to do that on stage, it would take me 10 years of development. I'd spend thousands on building a prop or building this effect, trial it so many times to get the exact same effect. You walked on stage with a microphone and made it happen in 30 seconds. You know, that is the kind of difference.
Yeah.
Because it happens in their head. And that's where I found the interest.
Yeah.
Partly because my hands were too small and I couldn't
sort of
do sleight of hands. So I gave
up. So I heard you say that, but for someone who's completely outside of that world, what does that even mean? Do you have, is it an advantage to have bigger hands for being a magician? Or?
It is. I mean, so Sam has really big hands, so he's a really good card magician. He can do things with cards and coins that I could only dream of.
Yeah.
But so having bigger hands, you can hide more in them. That's all I want to say. I don't want to give too much away infuriate the magic community. Yeah.
Is there like a rivalry between hypnotists and magicians and illusionists
So I think when you come into this sort of art of mystery performance, we'll sort of call an overarching bracket of it all.
Yeah.
You know, you've got magicians, and for some people, that's what they want to do. They want they're interested in creating a visual miracle, like quickly, where you can literally have a flash of light and a pack of cards appears, something like that, or where you're having someone pick a card and it jumps to the top of the deck.
Got it.
Those are really boring examples, but there are much more magical moments you can explore. Or you kind of end up on the sort of more psychological route.
Okay.
And a lot of magicians don't like the sort of psychological route because it's very much a lot of talking and there's a lot of sort of preamble until you get the payoff of, I'm going to reveal what you think, or I'm going to make you absolutely stick to the spot so that you can't move, or you are so afraid that you actually lose the ability to speak and talk and things like that. You know, a very psychological moment. But there's a lot of preamble to it. So some people like that quick payoff. Some people like the sort of longer route to...
So David Copperfield.
Yes.
Who is... Why, is he a magician? Illusionist?
Yes.
Magician.
Magician illusionist,
okay.
Yeah.
A magician is David Blaine.
David Blaine is a street magician.
Street magician?
Yes.
Dynamo.
Dynamo, again, street magician. He is the UK's answer to David Blaine.
Ah, cool. Okay. Now I'm starting to get it. Starting to get understand. Okay, cool. Every time I've got someone, I'm always like super curious to pick their brains to try and understand what it means, so I don't sound like a tool when I'm trying to explain.
Yeah, no.
Cool. So 15, you see this trick, and then suddenly you understand that there's this whole new avenue of like using the mind and words and I forgot what the word that you use a lot. Power of suggestion?
Yeah, power of suggestion, yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
that's the one.
And, you know, we use the power of suggestion every day. You don't have to be a hypnotist to use it. You know, you go into a doctor's surgery and they say, hey, take these drugs, they're going to make you better. You believe them because the suggestion is he knows what he's talking about.
Got it.
He might not. He might have just Googled it on your way in. But, you know, that's the suggestion, so you do what you're told.
Yeah, got it. And then one of the things that I thought was interesting is that you often said that you were really nervous and shy to perform to your friends and family, but on stage...
Yeah.
It was different.
It was. I was more nervous with magic than I ever was with the psychological stuff.
Really? Because it was depending on... Yeah, you had to get it right.
Yeah, and so I was terrified
that
they'd see the secret. And that was what terrified me so much. Oh. So I'd feel physically sick at the point of going up to show someone a card trick. It terrified me. It would.
And that's terrible.
Can you imagine that as a magician? Yeah. Genuinely, like a working magician? Like, sorry, bear with me. I'm going to just vomit all over your shoes. But let's do the magic trick now, okay?
Yeah. I'm ready.
Yeah. So the psychological stuff, there was a bit of a sort of caveat.
Yeah.
This is an experiment. It might not work. And so people knew that. It took the pressure off it somewhat. But I did still have that nerve going up, sort of performing it to small groups of people. It just wasn't as easy. Whereas you put me on stage... absolutely fine. Put me in front of 5,000 people, not a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get that. And one of the things, I think one of the cliches you hear often, typically when you'll hear someone who's gone into an unconventional career and avenue, is that you were the guy at the back of the class, you know, sending notes to people and mucking about, but you weren't. You were super academic.
Yes.
You got like 90% plus over your A-levels.
Yes.
Yeah. But you didn't get an invitation in the university of choice or the first year you applied to go into medical school. You didn't get an invitation.
Yeah. So at the same time when I found sort of hypnosis and performing, I was rubbish. I was annoying friends. I was annoying family, trying all these different approaches that didn't work.
But where were you finding out all this? Like, was there a book you were reading? Is there like information material that people were like, I mean, how do you even start for someone
to
listen to this?
I'd seen Darren. So I started sort of copying some of his stuff and trying to unpick how he'd done what he'd done in order to sort of implement it in my own way. And then there was a couple of books I picked up. And if I'm absolutely honest, there is a lot more information out there that I didn't access. I didn't know it existed.
Okay.
And so I didn't access it. Mm. And so a lot of the stuff I started off developing initially was stuff that I came up with myself.
Okay.
I've later found out other people came up with it before me, but that's okay. I'm not going to take credit for it. But at the time I thought, oh, this is great. No one knows this exists.
This
is amazing. Yeah. It turns out lots of people have, but you know, that's kind of where it started. And at that point, there was no chance that was a career option. You know, I wasn't a performer by any means.
Nah.
Love being on stage. Love standing up and giving talks. You need me to give a presentation on...
Do you remember your first performance on stage?
Yeah, so that was doing magic in primary school in year 6 for a talent show.
So how old, for people like me who don't understand the English system, how old were you?
11.
Okay. 11 years old, your first, and you remember it?
Yeah, I do, yeah. Yeah, I remember exactly what I did in it as well. It was all very magic.
Did it work?
It did, yeah. And I loved it. Then that moment, I got the stage bug.
And it
wasn't about just being on stage performing magic.
No.
I will happily stand up in front of anyone and talk about anything.
Yeah,
and that went all the way from school.
That.
I was very confident. But, you know, at 15, it wasn't working. It wasn't even an option to be on the table as a career.
Mm.
In my school, you know, you had to pick your A-levels at 15, 16, which I did. So I went for biology, chemistry, maths, and physics. Plus an advanced extension in biology as well, because that's what I wanted to do at that point. Having said that, I should have gone for something like business studies. It would have paid off a lot more. But, you know, 15, 16, what did I want to do?
Yeah, no one knows.
You know, I was very academic. And if you were academic and you liked people, you went into medicine. That was kind of what you did.
Sure.
So I went through my A-levels, did extremely well. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't something that was natural, you know.
Sure.
I genuinely worked at it, and I did very well from it. And as I went through that, I applied to med school, and despite a really good sort of CV, which is a personal statement for the university, and despite amazing grades, not a single
interview. What happened? Looking at it now, I mean, especially now, like being a bit older, looking back at it, and I know it's a blessing because, you know, we'll talk about what happened next, but you must have been like devastated.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I was inconsolable for weeks and weeks and weeks. I was lost. I genuinely, I'd worked for the last sort of 3-4 years to get to that point, and suddenly
and you ticked all the boxes.
Wasn't there.
Yeah,
absolutely. And yet there was people sat behind me in the biology class when I got the news that did get into med school or did get, like, they got their interview and then they got into med school, and I knew their grades weren't as good. I knew they'd not done as much work experience, and suddenly I was like, how the hell have you done this? And I'm sat here like, what do I do with my life?
That must have bruised the ego.
Absolutely. Took a good kick in and a while to sort of build back up there, really. And I explored other avenues. I was doing kind of a mock court thing at the time. So I looked at being a lawyer.
I heard you said a joke once about, like, you know, if you, since you failed to get into med school, you might as well go into law.
I know, it was so
and all my family are lawyers. I laughed. That's why I kind of laughed at that.
Yeah, I'm going to pay for that with some of my friends later, I'm sure. Thanks for bringing that up
again. You're welcome, mate.
Reminding everybody. Hope no one had
but
heard that.
But before, you know, what? Still, I just want to go, like, if you had to go back and think about what happened, could you now say, like, oh, I get why that happened?
Yeah, and the reason was I picked universities that just weren't right for me. I did apply to Nottingham, which is where I ended up going, and I didn't get any interview. And part of the reason for that was my personal statement wasn't quite structured in the right way that they were looking for.
Okay.
You know, my UK CAT score, for instance, was which is like an aptitude test, kind of like the... the American version of
SAT.
It's kind of like that for specifically for med school.
Got it.
And it was bang on average for my year. And so I applied to a couple of universities that just looked at that.
Okay.
And so that being bang on average didn't give me that boost that I needed. But to put it in perspective of how close it was, I got 617 and a half out of, I think it's like 1,000 points.
Okay.
And my friend got 618. That's 0.5 of a difference. Yeah. And this friend only applied to med school because I said, hey, my first day of sixth form, where I was about 16, I said, I've got to go and put my name on a list downstairs to apply to medicine. I'm interested in it. He was like, cool, I'll come with you. All right, I might as well put my name down too. And he literally put his name down. I was like, you are kidding me. He gets in on 618 and I don't on 617 and a half. Can you tell I'm still bitter? I can remember the numbers still.
I was about to say, clearly, but, you know, but yeah, I get that.
That's how competitive getting into med school is.
But had that not happened, you wouldn't have gone and spent some time in America at the camp, at the art camp, where you were teaching and re-fell in love with performing.
Yeah.
You know, and every day, was it like every day you had like 100 kids or I forgot what it was?
Yeah, so I was lucky. So I took a year out. That was my decision. I was going to reapply to med school. I went and worked in a hospital for six months to get experience, just advanced my CV essentially, reapplied, got 4 interviews, 4 offers, very happy, chose Nottingham. That's where I always wanted to go. Cool. Got in. At this point, we're at sort of May. The guy I just told you about was called Matt Wormsley. I'll name drop him straight in here. He accidentally forgot to submit some documents to Manchester where he was going, and so they delayed his entry for a year. Yep, so suck it, Matt.
That's divine justice right
there. It was so glorious. And I remember he texted me, he's like, hey, man, I need to talk to you. Can we meet up? And I was like, oh, my gosh, what's happened? Like, you know, has something awful in his life happened? He's like, oh, yeah, I forgot to fill in some forms, so I've got a year out. Like, what do you want to do? So we went to Australia together, we
really?
Went traveling, and it was great. It worked out perfectly. but it's sort of like the June time just before I went, my focus was get to med school. You know, that's what I've been working for years. Yeah. Loved it, loved the idea. I was super academic, couldn't wait to, you know, put all the effort in that I possibly could, come out of med school in five years and be a doctor.
Boom. Life sorted.
That was it. Like, that was my life goal.
So you were just thinking that this was just like a hobby, like just like a play?
Literally a hobby. And you apply for it with sort of Camp America that I was using. You apply and you put your skills. And I didn't put magic on. Magic wasn't on there.
Hmm.
And they called me up and they said, hey, we see you've put gymnastics down, because I used to do gymnastics, obviously, you know, magic, gymnastics kind of goes hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were like, that's full. Like, you need to pick something else. And I scrolled down the list. I was like, oh, magic. Yeah, well, I do the mind reading stuff and the hypnosis. Yeah, I know some card tricks. Yeah, cool. I'll just put that.
Yeah.
No one will ever think about it.
Sure.
I've got 2 black belts in 2 different martial arts. I'm going to get picked for that. Like, that's what people are going to pick me for to
what
teach
are the
that
arts?
Over summer. So it was jujitsu and a Korean karate.
Japanese jujitsu?
And a Korean karate called Tang Sudo.
Okay.
So I did those, had dan belts in both of those, was so passionate, was teaching them every week as well. So I was like, that's exactly what I'm going to get picked up for. 3 days later, the phone goes, and it was the camp director saying, hey, so we want you to come and teach magic. And I was like, okay. He was like, so how many tricks do you know? I was like, I don't know, 100? Like,
I've
got no idea. Just making it up on the spot. Just say yes and work it out later is kind of my life
You'll
motto.
Learn 100 on the plane.
So actually, when me and Matt went to Australia, I was there literally like flicking through books, learning card tricks. He was so bored of me by the end of it, just so that I had something to teach these
kids. All right, Matt, pick a card.
Again, I'm literally so jet lagged. Please just leave me the hell alone.
Stop making me guess the card.
But you know, that was what I was prepping for. And the camp was beautiful. It's an arts camp that was basically there for kids who, you know, throughout the year, typically were at schools where the things that they loved, like performing on stage or, you know, arts and crafts or whatever that is, they were probably shunned a little bit or bullied, and you know, a lot of the kids came to there. And there was this amazing camp where they could come for 3 weeks and just be themselves and express everything they wanted about themselves. And if they wanted to star in a play, great, go and star in a play. They want to star in a musical, they want to play in a band, great, we'll make it happen. It was an awesome, like, it was the place of dreams, and it still is. And it had such an infectious energy about it. But I got there, I was like, do you know what, let me just get this done and go to med school. I can't wait. And by the end of the summer, I was like, I don't want to go to med school. I just fell in love with performing. I fell in love with the whole area of the arts, and I was suddenly like,
how old were these kids?
So these kids were 10 to 16.
Interesting. Yeah, it's like in the, almost at that time when you fell out of love with magic around 13, and then here you are teaching these kids around that age to reconnect with it.
Absolutely. That's cool. And, you know, they were doing all sorts, and some of the things they did was come to me and learn magic. And every 3 weeks, we'd change the kids. But at the end of the 3 weeks, we had to put on a show. So you could opt to be involved. So there was anything between sort of 20 and 50 kids. And I had to write a show. I had to teach them it. I had to rehearse it with them. And then we had to perform it in front of the whole camp of 400 people plus 400 staff, so 800 people.
This is like in American films. You always see these American films, all these kids come together next to a lake in the woods, and they've got like all these activities and
it
stuff.
It was exactly that. And when Jeff was like, yeah, we're going to offer you the magic tuition position, I was like, okay. So I Googled the camp and I was like, hell yes, I'm going here. There's a lake, there's wakeboarding. Count me in. This is great.
That's amazing. It's like Miss Maisel when they go on holiday.
So good. But I just left with this infectious energy that I couldn't deny. It was there. It was burning inside me.
And so you go back home and you're like telling your parents, right, I want to go and become a magician. And they're like, wait a minute.
Yeah, so that didn't happen until February. So that was about 7 months after I got back from camp. I'd started med school and I was depressed. Like, it's not something I talk about particularly often or open, but I couldn't put my finger on it. I was miserable. And
what is that?
So I went home. I just literally packed my bags one day, went home for the weekend, got there, and my parents were like, oh, what are you doing here? Why are you home? And I was like, I just need some time at home. And they're like, are you okay? I was like, not really. I don't know what's up. I just feel flat. That's the only way I can describe it. And it's like, I don't want to talk about it. Please just let's move on. Let's just kind of crack on. And they would not drop it. They just kept asking me and asking me. And they were like, you know, have you got friends? Yeah, of course. Got loads of friends. You going out? Yeah, I'm going out every night. You enjoying the course? Yeah, love the course. Like, really challenging. And I just couldn't put my finger on it. There was something missing. I did love academia, but I wasn't top of the class. You know, I'd gone to a med school where there were genuinely geniuses in that room.
People with 6.17 plus 0.5 over.
Yeah, yeah, just geniuses. Yeah. And, you know, I'd gone from being top of my school, literally top of my school, to being average. And that killed me inside. It was a big change. It wasn't something I was expected.
Because your identity was pegged around like, oh, I'm the top of my class, I'm an academic, and therefore if I'm not, who am I?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I just that's who I was. I was good at academia. I was very clever. You know, I was, they'll probably shoot me for this, but the cleverest of my friends. And I'm going to pay
You're going to get so
later.
Much
I'm
stick. So,
the lawyers, my friends. I'm going to leave here depressed because I'm going to have no one left to talk to.
But you can call me, mate.
Yeah, well, that's all right. That's great. Me and you, Mark, we'll hand it out. But yeah, that, you know, the truth of it is that I just didn't know what I was doing in my life. Something was missing. That love that I'd had at camp 8 months before.
Sure.
Was gone. Wow. I was a hole. And so my parents basically turned around a couple of weeks later and was like, look, you need to decide. I was like, look, I think I'm going to drop out of med school. I'm going to go and pursue magic. And they were like, it's not a career option. Like, you've got a good career option here. Stick with it. Do it. But perform. Just find every opportunity you can. So that's what I did. I started to organize shows at the university. And I started to perform every opportunity I got. And so I helped pay my way through med school by doing those shows. And I sort of built up this whole business and this reputation. I started to tour shows. So I did, I booked 3 nights at a theater. Why choose three? Don't know. I could have just chosen one, but it was a 300-seater theater. We might as well do three if we're doing one. Sam and I...
Do you remember the first time you received money for performing?
Yes.
How old are you?
I was just turned 20.
20. Yeah. How did that feel like?
It was great. It was 50 quid and it instantly went on the bar because I was a student. But, you know, it was great. And it wasn't proportional to the work that I put in.
Sure, of course.
You know, the fees have changed since then.
People were going, £50?
£50, right. And I remember because it was a student thing, it ran through the SU, so it took about 8 weeks to arrive to me. So, you know, I did the show and then 8 weeks later, £50 comes in.
Yeah.
This is great. This is a whole night out.
I've made it.
Yeah. And it's an amazing experience. Man. Suddenly I was like, maybe there is a business element to this.
And were you feeling something like, because I'm guessing that one of the things you might be chasing by doing these shows wasn't the money, I'm guessing, but it was more like that feeling you had back at camp in America of that reconnected to something that drives up the sense of purpose, actually.
So a sense of purpose, you know, I wanted to deliver a show that people would genuinely leave talking about. At that point, I probably was hoping they'd talk about me. That has changed. It is now about the experience rather than me. I'd rather people remember that feeling. So in 10 years' time, they go, oh, I saw this show once and it was this. Great if they remember my name. If they don't, they still remember that experience. Yep. But back then, yeah, of course, you know, I wanted people to experience this. And it was a challenge. I was suddenly setting myself a creative challenge outside of academia where I could strive to be the best I could be in it. And it really just had a fire that just kept burning.
And is that what helped you kind of, I don't want to say get out of the funk, but like help you through that difficult period when you were kind of finding your identity and you lost a bit that sense of self and reconnecting with performing, that helped you to kind of, you know, move forward? And
absolutely. Yeah. If I'd not done that, I wouldn't have stayed in med school. I think just all of it would have got on top of me.
Okay.
I think, you know, these days, and sort of going back over the last sort of 20 years still, like the pressure in schools is that at 14, 15, you're choosing your A-levels.
Yeah.
You know, at 16, you're doing your A-levels to pick a career for the rest of your life. You go to university to study a career with an idea. That is changing somewhat in that we have lots more opportunities to do our own thing now, which I think is one of the best things you can do. We're very fortunate as a generation to have those opportunities afforded to us.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there is still that pressure to go, what are you going to do? Like,
And at 15, your hormones all over the place.
I'm watching House at the minute. I might as well be a doctor. Sure, why not? Like, I was watching CSI. I'm going to be in forensics.
Good thing you weren't watching The Wire. You could be a drug dealer or something. Or a cop.
Yeah, but, it's so difficult. And at that point, I didn't know what I was going to do. So I followed what I thought was my dream and my aspiration. Yeah. And to be fair, had I have not gone to the performing side of things over that camp in the summer and never found it, I probably would have been happy as a doctor.
Sure.
I would have made a good living. Sure. I don't know where I would have ended up, but you know, I would have stayed. But I found it.
Because you did the 5 years, and at the end of the 5 years, you go to 12 weeks kind of experience. That's where people go off to Australia, what have you, to go and do some experience. I actually had Dr. Rupi Aujla. I don't know if you know him. He's the guy behind the Doctor's Kitchen. Awesome dude. He came on the show, and he's on a mission to try and get food to be medicine, because he says that having 3 hours of nutrition in a whole GP degree is ridiculous. And so he's going on a mission to try and create more awareness around food and the power of transformational medicine through food.
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest things with healthcare in general is the education. That's what needs investing in, you know. Part of what made leaving medicine slightly easier is the current political climate of medicine and the NHS and things like that. I won't get too much into it, but, you know, it made it an easy decision to leave because there's so much uncertainty there as to what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And whereas actually working for myself, I had that control.
Okay.
I knew what I was going to do and I had a direction to take it in. But you know, that's a really difficult area. And education is the only way we're going to be able to reform the NHS.
Yeah, I get that. And so it's 5 years over, you graduate.
Yep.
And then was there a pressure from your family or people around you saying, are you going to go and be a GP now? Like, you've done all this and you were, and did you become a GP? Did you turn that down?
No, so at the end of med school, you go in, you do your sort of 12 weeks placement. But before that, in the sort of November, you finish med school in sort of April time, May time, and you use 12 weeks. And then you start your first placement in August.
Mm-hmm.
So that is when your junior doctors come in. Statistically, the worst time to go into hospital. So if you do get sick, don't go in August. It's all the newbies that are coming in fresh out of med school. Top
June,
for
June's
you.
The time to
June, go. Exactly. They're all trained up by then. They all know what they're doing. It's bang on time. So you've got to be ill. June's the perfect time.
Got it. Make note.
But, you know, I sort of, in the December, you have to apply.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I went, I'm not going to apply. I'm not going to apply for my job. And that was a difficult conversation to have with my parents, because I'm going home going, hey, so this sort of thing I've been doing on the side with med school that's been going okay, but it's not paying the bills, but it's paying some bills. I'm going to do that, and I'm not going to take the guaranteed 26 grand a year job that is literally there for me to apply to and take. And that was very difficult for them to get their heads around. And neither of them are academic, neither of them are doctors, neither of them went to university. And they were super proud that I got into university.
Sure.
And there was never there was never a pressure to do anything, but it was a pressure to do the best you could.
Okay.
And since I was in med school, the best I could do was be a doctor. Mm. And there was obviously an element of being proud of that. I mean, I would say, hey, my son's a doctor. Mm. Like, there's an element of, particularly from my parents' generation, if you were a doctor, that is up there in the social standing. Yeah. If your kid's a doctor, that's something you're going to shout about.
Yeah.
And so they were like, what are you doing? Yeah. Like,
what are you doing to us? This was our identity. Like, you were gonna
we spent so much money on sending you to med school and so you're tell our leaving? Friends. Great. Yeah. And so that took a while for them to kind of adjust that sort of idea. But I did my sort of 12-week placement. I did it at Great Ormond. I did 6 weeks at Great Ormond Street and 6 weeks in Derby. So I didn't go abroad because I wanted to know if I was coming back to medicine, I had a good CV piece, which was Great Ormond Street. And I love kids. I love working with kids. Yeah.
That's a kid. I mean, for people who don't know, that's a kids hospital.
It is. It's the UK's kind of leading children's hospital.
Yeah.
It's literally world renowned.
Oh, that's why. I think there's someone here who created a magazine with his son to raise funds for that hospital. That's how I know the name.
It does incredible work.
Cool.
And so I was lucky enough to get the opportunity to go there and see the work they do and also work with them in sort of, you know, a minor capacity. But, you know, if I was going back, I'd probably go to pediatrics or maybe obstetrics, something along those lines, because that's what I love. But so I did that and then, didn't start the job. And suddenly I'm there.
What happens if someone on the plane says, is there a doctor on the plane?
So this happened on a train. So I was on the train to Paris.
Yeah.
I was on the...
Eurostar.
Eurostar, that's the one. So I was on the Eurostar and we were just about to enter the tunnel. And a tannoy announcement goes, I just got my results 2 days before to say I was qualified and I was a doctor. And I hear on the tannoy going... ladies and gentlemen, if there's anyone on the train that is a medical professional, a doctor or a nurse, if you can make yourself known. And I'm hearing this going, and in my head, I'm just going, I am 2 days qualified. This isn't good. There'll be a proper doctor on board. I'll leave it. If they do a second announcement, I'll definitely rush up and go. Maybe slightly hungover from the celebrations from passing, but you know. And suddenly I feel people run past me. I kind of stir because I was half asleep. I wake up and it was literally on my carriage. And so I was like, oh, yeah, should probably do something about this. So I did. I ran over and sort of did my thing and helped. And, you know, it was that moment of, I've got to do something.
Yeah, because you swear an oath, right? I don't know if it's the same thing in France, but like in France, as a doctor, you have to step up and go, you know, as part of like, I will do no harm. And
yeah, and I think, you know, and this goes out to anyone. If you're not a doctor, if you're not a medical professional, please go online. Go to a course, learn a bit of first aid, learn CPR. That can genuinely save someone's life. Learn how to use a defibrillator. Mm-hmm. If you're not a medical professional and someone is collapsed, you can save their life.
Yeah.
Do that. Just takes half a day. Costs virtually nothing. Go out, do it. We will decrease the death rate from heart attacks and things like that.
Mm.
No end if people go could and just learn get the how basics. To do it.
It should almost be compulsory part of the education system.
Yeah,
it?
Absolutely. So obviously I got up, I sort of went along because I should have done in the first place. I was kind of half asleep, so I wasn't sure. But sort it out. It was absolutely fine. But you know, it's happened since. It happened a year ago. Yeah. I literally saw a child.
So you could still, like, if someone's still, like, to this day, like if today you were on a plane and someone says they're a medical professional.
Yeah, so I'd attend, and if there was no one else, I would do everything that I could possibly do to help in that situation.
Yeah.
If there was a senior position there, I would assist. That is my go-to. But about a year ago, a little girl got knocked over in front of me.
Okay.
I didn't see it happen. The guy who was driving saw it happen. It was actually Sam. He saw this little girl get knocked over. She kind of got up and walked towards the curb, and he's like, oh, that girl's just been knocked over. Jumped out the car, ran over. Instantly realized she'd broken her leg, and I was like, okay, great. Literally, that training kicked in. I'd not done it in 3 years, instantly.
Crazy.
So, you know, checking everything was okay, reassuring someone's on the phone to the ambulance, coordinating that. Amazingly, a GP walks up. It's like, hey, what's going on here? Did the briefing. He's like, cool, sounds like you've got it covered. I'll leave you to it. I was like, gonna leave. Okay. And then a radiologist walked up and he was like, oh, yeah, it's probably broken. Not much I can do, so I'll leave you to it. Sounds like you've got it covered. And then a pediatrician walks up. I was like, what are the chances you get three doctors within this area?
She was
area?
A lucky girl.
And they were just like, yeah, you've got it. It's fine. I'll leave. And I was like, what do you mean you'll leave? But no, it was fine. I stayed in touch with the parent. She ended up having to have an opt to put a pin in to the leg. But yeah, she's made a full recovery.
Man. Good for you. That's awesome. And you know, obviously now we're kind of coming towards, you know, the end of the interview, especially around like on your journey. You've been doing shows now for how long? Like 6 years, five, 6 years?
So I've been doing shows since 2011. So
okay.
What's that, 8 years?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in the sort of style and format that I do them now.
Yeah.
So I've been doing those 8 years and 4 years professionally. So that's where I've been full time this is my this is my income.
Okay, because you took a break from the Fringe this year, right?
I did.
But you prepared a really cool show in Manchester. Was it last night?
It was last night. Yeah. Yeah.
Aaron, how did it go?
It was incredible. It really was. It was just insane. So it's called The Vanishing Cabaret. And I've partnered up with my business partner, Sam, who helps me write the shows, and another magician called Joel.
Yeah.
And together we decided to bring a bit of the Fringe down to Manchester.
Got it.
Where people can see live entertainment. Amazingly, as big of a city as Manchester is, there is very little to see in terms of live entertainment. If you want to see something like magic or alternative comedy as opposed to just like the comedy club, like there's very few places that do anything. Literally, you go to TripAdvisor, three places maybe. So we wanted to bring that sense of Fringe. We've got an intimate speakeasy. There's literally 45-50 tickets max. That's it. And you literally get pretty much the best seat in the house is every seat. We move around the audience. We tried something very different. And last night I literally put together an act. For the last 6 months I've been working on trying to develop something slightly new and different, because I knew people would be there that have seen the previous show. So I wanted to show them something new. I wanted to challenge myself, and this is sort of the idea of the creativity driving me forward to be different and do more. And yeah, luckily it went down well.
Yeah.
As I said, it's an experiment. You never know how these things are going to go. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was incredible.
And so when you get to the stage, and there's so much more I wanted to talk about, we haven't even get touched, like your Thomas Cook kind of partnership that you did, where you went 30,000 feet, hypnotized a bunch of frequent flyers and made them believe that they'd never flown before.
That was absolutely
Is that true? Is that is
absolutely.
Because I've got to ask you, mate. I've got to just be, every time I see this kind of stuff, I'm like, is that fake? Is that true? And obviously, I hope you tell us the truth of this show.
Yeah.
But it's true.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Hand on heart. That same as the Channel 4 program. That
Hello
came
Stranger.
Out, like, Hello Stranger, yeah. You know, everything we do has to be true. Everything that I do on that screen has to be absolutely true, particularly for Channel 4, because it was factual entertainment. It wasn't just entertainment.
Got it.
It was factual. We were held to guidelines.
How was that for you to go from like performing live events, doing your shows, to suddenly, however that happened, getting on a show like on Channel 4 performing, like I wish we had more time, but really quickly, like, how was that? And what was the pressure like?
Okay, so incredible experience. Yeah. That came because Sam happened to meet one of the researchers who worked for the company we worked with, and she liked magic and said, hey, we've got this hypnosis idea. He went, oh, I know a hypnotist. And so we started talking.
Yeah.
And they basically said, hey, can you make it happen where you make someone forget someone else? And that was the start of the idea. And I said, yes.
Man, I was just sorry, I just couldn't pause. Like, because I know you got a partner, right? Yeah. I could just imagine you forgot to bring the milk and you have an argument.
Hey, we've never had an argument she remembers.
Yeah. That's right. It's like, can you just forget all the details?
She loves, she came to a show and I was like, look, I don't want to hypnotize you. I don't want that whole element.
Yeah.
And doing a live show, everyone stood up that's ended up hypnotized, and she stands up and I was like, oh, for God's sake, the rumors that are going to go around now, all my friends are going to be like, oh, so that's how you got her. So.
Anyway, sorry. So she was like, yeah, can I make forget someone? You were like,
so can I I've done it for sort of a minute and a half on stage. Yeah, can I do it for a full? Yeah, sure, I can. Just say yes, work out the plan later.
Yeah.
So Sam and I very quickly started to experiment with different things to try and find how we'd make that happen.
Yeah.
And we were very lucky to work with Wall to Wall to develop that program to where it kind of got to.
Okay.
So that was 2 years in the making.
Was it?
To get that to air. Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
What, absolutely. From the project, like conversations to filming? And
so
airing.
18 months of filming and then the edit.
18 months of filming?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's much longer than I thought.
Yeah, so we had to, but Channel 4 said, hey, yeah, we love it. We love the concept.
Okay.
Prove it works.
Okay.
And we went, oh, yeah, okay.
That's a good point.
Sure. Mm. All right. So we put out the casting. We needed to find a couple.
Okay.
And the trouble is we needed to find a couple that could both be hypnotized, which obviously isn't the easiest task.
Okay.
But not just be hypnotized. Hypnotized to a level where they are able to forget each other. Again, when I talked about sort of that small group that are able to pull off these amazing feats, we're looking for two of those in a current relationship.
Mm.
So it took a while to find those.
So you must get so many people to apply, and you must, like, that must have taken ages.
Yeah, the casting is definitely the hardest bit. Like, there's a pressure on as well, because obviously there's a budget behind these sort of things.
Of course.
There is only a limited budget assigned to casting.
Got it.
If you're not going to cast in that time, you go over budget, suddenly you're in big trouble. So there's a pressure on me.
Yeah.
I'm literally stood at the front of a room with, 20 people going, great, okay, I'm going to make this happen. If it doesn't work, I'm screwed.
My career's on the line.
I'm never going to trust a word I say. I'm not going to have a TV show now. And so, look, we found a couple of different couples. We found a married couple that were great, and we did it. We did it over a day. That was it. We proved to Channel 4 okay. It worked. And, you know, the couple that ended up being aired over the sort of three-day experiment, you know, they had their own Instagram career, which is great. They're doing really well with that. But because of that, I think there was less believability from the audience that it was genuinely real because they had something to gain from it.
Okay.
Whereas I really wish we could have used the original couple who we tried it on, who were married. They had no gain. They genuinely just wanted to have a great time and see if they'd fall in love again. That was their only reason for being involved.
It's a great title. I love the title, Hello Stranger.
Yeah.
That was very cool.
It started off at some really weird ones. we go through so many different titles.
Do you remember some of the titles?
Look Into My Eyes was the first one. And then we had, there was one that stuck for ages and it was just terrible. Every time it came through in an email, I was like, we've got to change this name. I'm not watching that and I'm going to be in it. Like, it's just not going to happen. So, you go through lots of different titles. Hello Stranger happened to be the one that stuck.
And was that like a bit like, I guess, a point in your journey where you really, like, we keep on knocking these?
No, I know. I'm glad I didn't do it. It's the suggestion that I did it that made you do it. There we go.
That's right. There was that point in your career where you kind of like took off like on a whole different dimension, I'm guessing, if you're being broadcasted on national television. Did people start recognizing you? Did you start getting booked a bit more? Like, did that make a bit of a difference?
It did. I mean, the difference was because it wasn't necessarily a straight entertainment program, there were some bookings that came in, but as with TV, everything is short-lived because as soon as you're on TV, the next thing's on. And, you know, the big sort of corporate companies want the next big thing. So I've been lucky that sort of my corporate work has continued to come in, but it did bring me back to an avenue that I'd been exploring anyway, which was hypnotherapy. People wanted help with certain problems, and that sort of tied into my medical aspect and into hypnotherapy and working with clients on that sort of level. And of course, it did boost my career. You know, I left med school the middle of 2015, and I genuinely didn't know what I was doing. I had no experience actually running a full-time business. I had no idea on how to sort of be in touch with new corporate clients because I'd built a base in Nottingham. I was now in Manchester. There was no way that sort of I can travel to those, but they weren't constant enough to bring in the money that I needed to put a roof over my head. And suddenly I'm in this field where I'm completely lost and out of my depth, going, what do I do? Where's my direction? I said I was going to be a magician for a living, or a performer, or a mind reader, hypnotist, whatever you want to call it.
How do I take care of the business aspect?
Do now? Yeah. And for the first month, there was a lot that happened in that sort of first month. My granddad sadly passed away. The girlfriend I was with at the time
That actually, I heard you say this. I thought that was quite moving. You said that the morning that your grandfather passed away would have been the day you would have started your job as a doctor.
Yeah,
is that
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. If I had taken a job as a doctor, I wouldn't have been there for when my granddad passed away. Which would have killed me inside. Wow. I don't know what I would have done with myself.
Isn't that funny how life is?
Yeah.
You know, like you had you not been, you know, quote unquote, rejected from university, not got in, you wouldn't have gone to America.
Nope.
You wouldn't have fallen back in love with magic. You know, wow. I mean, I'm always amazed when you hear these stories, you just go, wow. You know, when you look back, it's easy. It sounds logical, but it's just everything.
It could have gone so many different ways, and it didn't. And it led me to this point where literally the moment, you know, moments after my granddad passed, I walked out of the room and bumped into two of my fellow colleagues from Nottingham that had studied and had just taken their first day as a job as a doctor, and they walked in, they're like, hey, what the hell are you doing here? I didn't think you were doing this. And I was like, I'm not here for that. But they were great and really supportive. It's funny how life sort of works out in that way.
So what's next?
What's next? That is the big thing. So at the minute, we are working on The Vanishing Cabaret. We were making it monthly. So every month, there'll be a live event in Manchester that people can come and see some great mind reading, some great magic, some great hypnosis as well.
Cool.
There's a couple of TV shows in the background. Unfortunately, as with the TV world, you can never talk about them until they come out.
I know.
But also, I have that sort of rule that I never want to be that guy that goes, hey, I'm doing this new show. It's going to be like this. And then it never sees air. And everyone's like, he does lots. But, you know, that's the nature of TV. You know, the story really is that most of my everyday life is working for corporate companies. So I do corporate training. I do hypnotherapy for clients as well. That's what happens most of the time. The fun stuff is when I get to come to London to production meetings and booking.
Come on the podcast, The Unconventionalist.
Come on the podcast. Great opportunities like this. It's incredible. And then a tour. So there will be a show. It will tour. It will be next year. I'll be taking the live show out to as many people as possible.
Cool,
that's where my heart is. That's what I love.
Yeah, and I can see you doing well that way. And I mean, you're a good-looking guy. You're in great shape. Usually when you look at hypnotists and in the world of illusions and magicians, you know, you kind of like, it's a bit like weird creatures can come out of that.
With that, you know, risking offending a third group of people between the lawyers, my friends, and now magicians and other individuals.
They use it to get laid. You were about to say something.
You know, that, you know, part of the reason a lot of magicians go into being a magician is because they don't have social skills. That's a sweeping statement. I realize that's not true for a lot of them, but it is, because they go, I can't talk to that girl, so I'm probably going to show her a card trick, because then she'll sleep with me. That's not really how it goes. I'm sorry to spoil it if that's your expectation.
He's just alienated a third of the population, which is good. And he's like, that is
great. I'm honest. You know, I'm not going to lie. You know, magic was a crux for me when I started, because 100%. I wanted to be the center of attention. Yeah. But, you know, that's kind of how it went.
Cool.
But yeah, there is that sort of stereotypical sort of creepy guy who sort of is that weird uncle that kind of knows a few magic tricks. And that's the kind of vibe you get from a magician. And we're slowly sort of changing that. Yeah. And that was my whole goal with what I was doing with hypnosis, is I want to change people's perception of hypnosis. And because of that, I've turned down amazing opportunities, TV shows, big theater bookings, where it hasn't fallen within my brand.
Got it.
Where it is that typical comedy hypnosis show that
get someone naked and act like a chicken.
It doesn't work for me. Yeah. It's not me. And I could have happily made a lot of money and been very popular doing it. I've not, so now I'm unpopular and don't make much money doing what I love, creating this brand.
Yeah, that's priceless though.
Absolutely. You know? Like, I love what I do and I love creating this thing. And hopefully over time, with the things that I do between sort of the Thomas Cook, the Hello Stranger, and the next projects that I'm working on, that will sort of continue to move in that way. Yeah. And, you know, the stage show that you saw, it's going to sort of change people's perception. Yeah. Granted, a few hundred, a few thousand at a time.
Well, I think, you know, coming to the end of the questions, I think one of the things I love about you is that it's because you bring an element of credibility, I want to say, almost to the game, being a trained medical doctor, you know, having that kind of academic background. And then you bring that into a world that for a lot of people is a little bit like, okay, come on, you know, is it real? Is it fake? And all this stuff. And what I love about you is that you have these two aspects. You've got the entertainment. Let me give you an experience so that you can be in community while having this experience. And you go through this thing and you go like, whoa, what just happened? And there's this bond that happens in the room because you look at each other and you kind of go, did she just put a nail, whatever it was? I forgot, you know? And you also have the one-to-one practice where you help people through genuine fears. Like, I've got fear of spiders or flying, or I don't like my body. I don't like the way I'm eating. And so you help people go through these difficult things. So I think it's a really cool mix, and I wish you every success.
Thank you.
I have no doubt that, you know, you will continue to rise, and whatever big project you can't speak of now, I hope that by the time
I hate saying that. I know. It's such a tease. It's such an
But I get it. So what's one thing that most people don't know about you?
God, one thing that most people don't know about me, I probably touched on it earlier, I'm a pretty good gymnast. I can still vault over a box and do somersaults and handsprings and head springs. I can't do the splits.
I was about to say, can you do the splits? Because if you can, you're doing the splits now.
No, I can't do that. But I grew up trying everything. I can horse ride, I can trampoline, I can do gymnastics, martial arts. I grew up doing everything.
Cool, man.
One thing.
What does being unconventional mean to you?
Being unconventional. Being me. And I think in a world where we are so driven by everything we see online and we see sort of on Instagram, we are more than ever being afforded the opportunity, and I touched on this earlier, to do and make anything we want a living and a business. If you want to travel the world, you can make that a business. I know you talked with Colin, was it?
Yeah, Colin Wright, yeah.
Who was like the first one who made that sort of happen, made it.
The original
sort of
minimalist.
His life. Absolutely.
Yeah, crazy.
People
man.
Are now following that and making a lot of money on Instagram, but I'm kind of sat there going, are you doing that because you want to do it, or you're doing that because everyone else is doing it? And if you make it individual and you do, you will be happy, you'll be so much better off in life for it, you'll have a much more mental well-being, you know. I follow what I do. Yes, there are highs, there are lows, but I'm much better off doing that than I ever felt during my time in med school as well. So for being unconventionalist, I think more now than ever it has been before is be yourself. Don't be that person that you think you have to be on Instagram. Don't be that person who has to highlight all the happy moments in their life and only show the world that. Be you. Focus less on other people and more on yourself.
Love it. You know what? We're going to leave on that question because it's just a powerful statement. Love that. What's the best place for people to connect with you online?
Probably Instagram. That's the place I'm most active.
At
aaroncalvert.co.uk.
Okay. Aaron.
Wonderful. Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me in.
Thanks for coming.
It's great. Thanks.